So if your great-great-grandchildren were handed a folder tomorrow morning, right? And it had your bank statements, your calendar, your grocery receipts from just this past week. What do you think they would actually think of you?
Oh man, that's a heavy question right out of the gate.
It really is. But I mean, would they look at those choices and thank you for building their foundation? Or would they ask why you traded their inheritance and your own health, frankly, for a cheap t-shirt, a sugar high, and a weekend hangover?
Yeah, a lot of people would probably be pretty embarrassed by that folder.
Totally. And in my day job as a legacy-focused financial planner, this is basically what I do. My whole focus revolves around helping families make these long-horizon choices, about asset spending and intergenerational responsibility.
Right. Which I imagine is not what they expect when they walk in.
Not at all. They sit down expecting to talk about mutual funds or tax shelters. They just want a product. But honestly, the most potent tool for building generational wealth isn't a financial product. It's a psychological framework.
And that framework is exactly what we are getting into for you in today's deep dive. We are looking at Chapter 14, Make Decisions That Hold Up for Seven Generations. That's from the book Laws of Life, Book 2, Now Build the System for Your Life by Jack Spurko.
Yeah, and it's just such a phenomenal
It
chapter.
really is. In my own practice as a practical ethics and leadership coach, I spend so much time teaching self-discipline and decision-making across time. And what Spurko does here is he takes these massive, almost intimidating concepts like duty and legacy, and he grounds them into a totally actionable daily system.
I'm really glad you used the word intimidating. Because I have to admit, when I first heard the phrase make decisions that hold up for seven generations, my immediate reaction was, well, complete skepticism.
Oh, sure. I mean, it sounds a bit out there at first glance.
Right. Like we live in a culture where people can barely coordinate their weekend plans by Thursday afternoon. So asking a normal person to extend their mental timeline seven generations into the future, it just sounds absurdly impossible, like science fiction or something.
It definitely sounds like this impossible burden if you view it through the lens of our modern hyper-fast, consumer culture. But the brilliance of this concept is that it's actually the ultimate pragmatic tool.
Yeah, completely practical.
But to see why it works, we have to like completely redefine what legacy actually means. Because our society has a super distorted, almost cartoonish view of it.
Really do. People tend to focus on what Spirko calls a direct legacy,
Exactly, direct legacy.
which is just this ego-driven desire to be so rich or, politically important that you get your name slapped on a university building. Or maybe a bronze monument in a park somewhere.
Which, let's be honest, is ultimately meaningless because it fades so incredibly fast.
Exactly. Give it a generation or two, and literally nobody walking past that building has any clue who that person was. Your grand legacy just turns into a forgotten public record sitting on a server.
Right. But Spurko contrasts that empty ego trip with a second, far more powerful kind of legacy. He calls it a legacy of consequence.
A legacy of consequence. I love that term.
It's so good. It's the undeniable reality that every single life creates ripples. Spurko references Marcus Aurelius here, the idea that what we do echoes in eternity.
Yes, that quote perfectly captures it.
Right. So it's the idea that when you offer a kind word to a struggling stranger, you might completely alter the trajectory of their day. And because their day got better, they go home and treat their kids with patience instead of just snapping at them.
Which then teaches those children emotional regulation, right?
Exactly. And they pass that on to their children.
Yeah.
And obviously, the exact same compounding effect happens with a harsh word or a selfish action.
And that distinction, direct versus consequence, is where my financial planning clients almost always get stuck. They view legacy strictly as a real estate transfer or a trust fund.
Just a pile of cash.
Exactly. But what Spurko is arguing and proving, really, is that legacy is inherently behavioral. It's carried in your daily actions, not just your bank accounts. And to ground this, he takes us back to the actual origin of seven-generation thinking, which comes from the Iroquois Confederacy through their great law of peace.
Right, the alliance of the Mohawk, Oneida, Onondaga, Cayuga, Seneca, and Tuscarora tribes.
Yes, and within their governance, leaders were literally expected to weigh every major decision, not just on how it impacted the current tribe, but how it would impact the unborn.
A good choice benefits your kids. A great choice benefits your kids' kids.
Right. But we really need to understand why they did this. Because this wasn't, some mystical indulgence where they just sat around manifesting the future.
No, not at all. They instituted this framework to solve very real, bloody, immediate problems. They were dealing with warring tribes, intense resource pressures, political conflicts.
Yeah, because forcing a long-term perspective naturally filters out short-term greed. If you know a resource has to last for centuries, you literally cannot clear-cut the forest today just to be extra comfortable this winter. It forces a society to favor stewardship over exploitation.
It was so effective that the founders of the U.S. actually studied the Iroquois Confederacy when they were building American federalism.
Which is wild to think about.
Mm.
But practically, how do we wrap our heads around seven generations? The math can feel overwhelming.
Right, and here's the critical piece of math that makes it mentally manageable. When they talked about seven generations, functionally, they were talking about roughly a century.
Because a long human life is about 100 years.
Exactly. Demographers usually define a generation as maybe 20 to 25 years. So seven generations spans about 140 to 175 years.
Okay, so what does that actually mean for the listener?
Practically speaking, it means your actions really only need to have a tangible impact for about 40 years after your death for those consequences to carry across a full seven generations.
Oh, wow. So you don't have to literally predict what the world looks like in the year 2500.
Exactly. You just have to manage the immediate compounding ripple.
Which brings us to this brilliantly grounding story in the text. To prove that you don't need to be some major historical figure to leave a legacy of consequence, Spyrko traces his own family line.
I love this part of the chapter.
It's so relatable. So his great-grandfather was born in 1889 and immigrated to America from Ukraine in 1911. Then you have his grandfather, who lived through the brutal scarcity of the Great Depression and then got drafted into the Navy in World War II.
Right.
And that grandfather eventually became one of Jack's absolute best friends and primary mentors in the 70s and 80s.
And the crucial detail here is what was actually passed down to Jack. The inheritance wasn't a giant pile of gold bars. It was entirely behavioral and knowledge-based.
Right, the real wealth.
Yeah. His grandfather taught him how to garden, how to hunt, how to identify edible and medicinal plants in the wild. He instilled values through these classic fables like the grasshopper and the ant.
And then his grandmother, leaning on that same immigrant heritage, taught him traditional Ukrainian cooking and self-reliance in the kitchen.
Notice how seemingly mundane those acts are. Teaching a kid to garden or cook.
Yeah, just normal grandparent stuff.
But Spyrko points out that those specific quiet acts of mentorship cascaded directly into his 18-year career as a podcaster. He took the survival skills, the independence, the life lessons his grandparents gave him, broadcasted them to the world, and ended up positively impacting thousands and thousands of people.
People who will never even know his grandfather's name.
Exactly. That is the definition of a legacy of consequence.
Uh-huh.
But since we're establishing that legacy is built on daily behavioral choices, we need a functional mechanism to filter those choices in real time.
And that is where Spyrko introduces these two foundational filtering questions you can apply to any significant decision. First, how long will this decision have consequences? And second, what will that look like?
Simple questions, but they force a total perspective shift.
Totally. And to answer those questions, he breaks down what he calls the 7x7 decision filter. It basically forces you to evaluate an action across seven distinct time frames.
Right. The time frames are 7 hours, 7 days, 7 weeks, 7 months, 7 years, 7 decades, and 7 generations.
And if you look closely at that math, 7 decades aligns perfectly with the timeline of a modern 100-year human life.
Yeah, so if a 30-year-old runs a choice through the 7-decade filter, they are effectively asking, how is this going to impact my 100th birthday?
But introducing this filter brings up a massive psychological barrier, which I see in my practice constantly. People violently resist this kind of long-term thinking. They actively fight against self-discipline.
Oh, absolutely.
The most obvious example is when I ask a new client to sit down and set a basic household budget. People will invent 100 reasons why they can't do it. They act like a budget is this restrictive, evil, external authority trying to ruin their fun.
Which is entirely ego protection. A budget is literally just a piece of paper where you dictate your own priorities. Nobody is forcing it on you. You can tear it up and change it whenever you want.
Exactly. So why the resistance?
Because people fear the mirror of their own self-discipline. They avoid accountability. If they commit to running their choices through the 7x7 filter, they intuitively know they're going to hate some of their own answers.
Yeah, they know they're messing up.
Right. So they end up burning way more emotional energy actively avoiding self-discipline than it would actually take to just sit down and be disciplined.
But as a leadership coach, I have to assume you see a major pitfall here. Because if I tell a client to run every single daily choice through a seven-generation filter, doesn't that guarantee total decision paralysis?
Oh, totally.
Like, how are you supposed to buy groceries or pick out clothes without triggering a full-blown existential crisis?
Yeah, that is the exact trap overthinkers fall into. And Spurko explicitly warns against it. Not every decision requires this heavy mental machinery.
Right.
If you're standing in your closet picking out socks for a Tuesday morning, there is absolutely no need to think beyond 7 hours. Most daily administrative choices only matter for a few days or weeks at most.
So you just have to contextualize it.
Exactly. The secret to this framework is reserving the 7x7 filter for the choices that actually carry compounding consequences.
And that concept of compounding consequences perfectly shifts us to where this filter is most vital, our most constrained resources. Money and time.
The big ones.
Yeah. Spurko drops a profound wealth lesson in this chapter. It's a reality check I try to hammer into my clients constantly. He writes, "I am the root of all wealth that I create."
You just the radical accountability in that statement. Not the broader economy, not the federal government, not society. You.
Individual behavior dictates wealth accumulation. History proves it. Massive fortunes were built during the depths of the Great Depression, the brutal stagflation of the 1970s.
Just as they were built during the post-war boom or the dot-com era.
Right. And conversely, generational fortunes were completely squandered during all of those eras, too. To drive this home, Spurko poses a brilliant scenario. What is the bigger financial sin? Squandering a dollar at age 20 or squandering a dollar at age 35?
The math and the psychology undeniably point to age 20.
Oh, 100%.
Think about it. At 20, your income is generally at its absolute lowest. Your working conditions are usually way harder, you know, bottom of the ladder, menial, exhausting tasks. So you physically suffered more to earn that single dollar?
Yeah, that's a great point.
Plus, that dollar at age 20 has a 15-year advantage of compound growth over the dollar earned at 35. But the most hidden danger is that the financial habits you solidify at 20 usually become your permanent trajectory.
Let's run the actual math on his concert spending example, because this is the moment where my younger clients usually physically wince.
Oh, yeah, this one hurts.
Okay, imagine you're 22 years old. You decide to spend $250 on a weekend concert. You buy the ticket, pay for the pre-gaming meals, buy the overpriced drinks at the venue, pay for the ride home.
Standard weekend.
Right. Now run that through the filter. What do you have in 7 days? Fun iPhone photos and a fading hangover. In 7 months, a t-shirt stuffed in a drawer.
But observe the trade-off. If you applied the filter, skipped the concert, and invested that $250 at a standard 10% market return, in 7 years, that money doubles to $500.
Okay, decent.
By the time that 22-year-old reaches age 65, that single skipped weekend is worth $17,000. And if we cast our vision out 7 decades, that original $250 becomes $197,186.
That is insane.
Yeah.
When I see a 22-year-old blow $250 on a random bender, I don't just see a fun Saturday. As a planner, I see someone taking a sledgehammer to a financial sapling.
Wow, that's a great image.
You aren't just breaking a tiny stick in the dirt. You're obliterating the massive century-old shade tree it was destined to become. This is my absolute favorite concept in the chapter, trading with your future self.
Yeah, you didn't just spend $250. Your 65-year-old self effectively had to pay $17,000 for you to have a hangover in your 20s.
Brutal.
That sapling analogy captures it perfectly. The wealthy fundamentally understand that dollars are not meant to be accumulated. Assets are. Dollars naturally lose value through inflation. But when you invest those dollars, they transform into leverage. They become, as Spurko bluntly puts it, your slaves working for you for the rest of your life. And this rigorous filtering applies to time just as ruthlessly as it applies to money, because time is the ultimate unrenewable currency.
He illustrates this beautifully with the education example.
Oh, this is a big one.
Yeah. Before you commit to spending years in a university classroom, run the degree through the filter. Ask yourself, will this credential actually advance my specific life goals? Or is it just a societal box I feel pressured to check off?
Could you extract the exact same functional, marketable skill from a 2-week boot camp?
Right, because you can always hustle and make another dollar, but you can never, ever recover a squandered year.
Exactly. So we've explored wealth and time, which are somewhat abstract. But Spurko makes sure to ground the 7x7 filter in the visceral, physical world. It applies directly to what we plant in the dirt and what we put into our bodies.
Let's talk about the tree example, because it's basically a masterclass in long-term versus short-term thinking.
Think about the Bradford pear tree. It is wildly popular in modern suburban developments. Why? Because it grows incredibly fast.
Right, so run it through the filter.
Yeah.
In 7 years, a Bradford pear looks fantastic. Decent shade, nice white flowers in the spring, good fall foliage, and it's cheap for developers to plant.
But open the timeline out to 7 decades, and the catastrophic flaws become undeniable.
Completely.
Because it's biologically wired to grow so rapidly, its wood is structurally weak. Long before they even reach 20 years old, they literally start splitting apart under their own weight.
Or they just get decimated by mild windstorms.
Right. They produce absolutely zero edible food, and the wood has zero timber value. It's the illusion of growth without any structural integrity.
Now, contrast that immediate gratification with planting a black walnut tree. A black walnut requires a real trade-off.
Yeah, it costs more up front.
And it takes significantly longer to establish itself. But run it through the timeline. In 5 to 7 years, it actually starts producing a caloric yield. If cared for, that single tree will drop enough nuts to feed your children and your grandchildren.
And when you look out 7 decades, that black walnut tree holds thousands of dollars in actual harvestable timber value.
Which seamlessly transitions us to the most intimate physical legacy we will ever manage, our own health and the food we consume.
Oh, man. Spurco distills his ultimate dietary philosophy down to 3 uncompromising words. Eat real food.
He pulls absolutely no punches when dissecting the long-term devastation caused by what he calls the SAD diet, the standard American diet.
Really is sad. We are talking about the mass consumption of high fructose corn syrup, industrial seed oils like canola and soy, and highly refined flours.
Flours that have to be enriched with synthetic vitamins just to keep people alive because the processing stripped all the natural nutrients out. Add in chemical dyes and preservatives with 5 syllables.
But to understand why we are surrounded by this food, you have to look at the history of food industrialization. Spurco traces the origins back to the post-Civil War era.
The nation was expanding rapidly.
Right, and the priority shifted to factory efficiency and mass distribution. The primary goal of the food industry became stabilization, making food shelf-stable so it could survive long train rides without rotting and leaning out production costs to maximize profit.
And that drive for efficiency led to synthetic fertilizers, which slowly robbed the topsoil of its natural trace minerals.
But the real turning point, the mechanism that broke our modern diet, happened in the 1970s.
Yeah, as the global economy shifted to a fiat monetary system, inflation soared. Food manufacturers were facing massive cost pressures.
So to keep prices artificially low, the industry aggressively swapped out natural cane sugar for high fructose corn syrup because heavily subsidized corn was dirt cheap.
And that economic shift created a total biological nightmare. Food conglomerates literally hired chemists to design what's known in the industry as the bliss point.
The bliss point is so insidious.
It's the precise, mathematically calculated ratio of fat, salt, and sugar that completely overrides your brain's primal satiety signals. They engineered the food so that you physically cannot stop eating it.
Your brain just tells you to finish the entire bag of potato chips.
Exactly. And the compounding consequences are horrifying. We are living through a modern medical epidemic. Kidney dialysis clinics are popping up in strip malls everywhere, looking like cell phone stores did in the late 90s.
It's terrifying. We have an explosion of type 2 diabetes and end-stage kidney disease. And Spurco highlights this terrifying paradox. We now have millions of morbidly obese people who are simultaneously literally starving to death.
Starving for micronutrients, not calories.
Right. Think about the natural world. No animal in the wild, regardless of how abundant their food supply is, eats itself into morbid obesity. This is a purely modern, chemically engineered phenomenon.
Which brings us back to the psychological trade-off between short-term costs and long-term taxes. People constantly argue that eating real, whole food-like, high-quality meats, fresh vegetables, local eggs, is just too expensive for the average family.
But the alternative is what? Grazing on processed snacks all day long like a first grader trying to give their teacher a 15-minute break.
Exactly.
When you shift your diet to real, nutrient-dense, food-like quality proteins and fats that keep you fully satiated on just 2 meals a day, the sheer volume of food you need to consume drops dramatically.
You just aren't as hungry.
Right. But more importantly, you have to view every piece of highly processed Bliss Point food as a hidden tax on your future health.
A box of heavily processed snacks might seem cheap at the cash register today, but wait until you get the medical bill for insulin, chronic inflammation, and dialysis treatments in 3 decades.
Exactly. So we've covered a tremendous amount of ground here, from intergenerational wealth to time management to the trees in our yard and the food on our plates.
How do we actually implement this without getting overwhelmed?
Spurco offers a very specific blueprint for this, an acronym he calls the Rooted Formula. It's essentially a timeline audit for your life.
And it's so practical.
Right. Think of Rooted not as a robotic checklist, but as a fluid process. It starts with ARVO, recognize the decision class. This is where you sort the trivial from the life shaping. Don't waste energy overthinking your socks, but absolutely slow down for a mortgage or a career pivot.
Next is OBITO, open the timeline. This is deploying the 7x7 framework. Force yourself to look past Friday and ask how the consequences play out over the decades.
The second O is observe trade-offs. This requires brutal honesty. You have to admit what you're gaining right now versus what you're forcing your future self to give up. Are you borrowing temporary comfort or investing focused effort?
Then comes to talk to future you. This one is incredibly powerful. Imagine sitting across a table from the 10-year-older version of yourself, explaining why you made today's choice, with absolutely no excuses allowed.
Next is ease, execute with discipline. Once you've done the audit and made the choice, just act on it. Stop constantly renegotiating the terms with yourself every time the work gets slightly uncomfortable.
And finally, document and review. Put a date on your calendar in the future to honestly assess how the decision played out. If you don't track the results, you'll never improve your judgment. You'll just get better at inventing stories to excuse your mistakes.
This entire audit process perfectly captures the distilled truth of Law 14. Short-term thinking invariably creates long-term damage. True legacy is consequence, not monuments. Discipline does not restrict your freedom. It is the very mechanism that creates it.
And perhaps most importantly, you don't need a crystal ball to predict the future. You just need to stop stealing from it.
That is such a profound realization.
And it's why a life guided by long horizon thinking usually looks incredibly boring in the present moment. Skipping the concert to invest $250 is boring. Choosing to cook a steak at home instead of hitting the drive-through for engineered chips is boring.
It looks boring today, but it results in a life that is absolutely extraordinary in hindsight.
Now, for anyone listening who wants to study these frameworks and integrate them, you can find a wealth of resources at jackslaws.com.
And as Spurco concludes this chapter, he leaves the reader with what he calls a mental computer code rewrite. These are 3 specific, definitive lines of programming to install in your own mindset. They are written exactly like this.
Computer. Anytime I slip into the mindset of short-term thinking, remind me that what I do now echoes in eternity.
Computer, whenever I resist long-term thinking, remind me it is only my own leadership and discipline I am avoiding.
Computer, when faced with important decisions, remind me to consider who I will leave behind and what legacy I'm leaving for them.
Once again, you can explore all of these concepts and tools further at jackslaws.com.
But as we wrap up this deep dive, we want to leave you with one final image to hold on to. The next time you're standing at a crossroads, whether it's a financial choice, a career pivot, or just what you're putting in your grocery cart, remember the trees. Ask yourself, am I planting a Bradford pear that looks good today but collapses in the first storm? Or am I planting a black walnut that will feed the generations to come?